on this episode of Skeptico.
I think consciousness studies is the most exciting frontier in science right now. I'm really burned out on cosmology and particle physics. They're still peddling multiverses and string theory, and it seems stale, and I don't even think it's very scientific. But by default, I still am a materialist, to the extent that I think if there will be understanding of consciousness and mind in general and all the, you know, the different aspects of the mind, it will come from probing the physiological underpinnings of the mind, which, as far as we know, is the brain itself.
What I have a problem with is the fundamental assumption, the paradigm, and that is that mind equals brain, that you are this biological robot in a meaningless universe. But the real problem that bugs me is that we have good evidence that that has been falsified. And even if you look at the story arc like I laid out there, hey, 20 years ago, no one was talking about consciousness being an emergent property. And there wasn't some discovery that brought that on. It was a default, a fallback position, because these guys who are peddling this consciousness is an illusion thing, they just got beaten down by the data.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we talk about science journalism. And while I've often been very critical of science journalism because it seems to be all about maintaining the status quo and ignoring data that goes against the party line, I can't say that about today's guest. John Horgan is not only a fabulous writer, a fabulous science writer, but someone who's willing to mix it up and sweep away the old ideas and take a fresh look at what's new and where science is really leading us. Of course, rather than spend an hour singing the praises of John Horgan's work, which I could do, I spent an hour picking and poking at the points in his writing and thinking that I disagree with. But then, this is Skeptico. That's what we do. So we talk about a number of topics in this interview. Of course, the state of science. We talk about near-death experience. We talk a lot about consciousness research. We even talk about ESP and telepathy and Rupert Sheldrake's work. All in all, it was terrific to have John on the show, and I thank him so much for joining me. I hope you enjoy this interview with John Horgan. Today we welcome award-winning science writer and author John Horgan to Skeptico. John has written a great deal about scientific dogmatism, materialism, consciousness, and so many of the other topics we love to talk about here on Skeptico. He's also written several books that we'll want to talk about in this interview, including The End of Science, Facing the Limits of Knowledge in the Twilight of the Scientific Age, fantastic title, Rational Mysticism, Spirituality Meets Science in the Search for Enlightenment, and The End of War. John, it's great to have you on Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
You know, first off, I have to congratulate you on this fabulous career that you've been able to put together. You're really a terrific writer, but as you know, that doesn't often translate into having a successful, sustainable career. I think you give hope to people who love to write and love science, and especially people who aren't afraid to ruffle feathers, but, you know, don't know if there really is a path for them to really be honest in their writing. So I guess the first question is, you know, how did a provocateur like you make it in as a science writer? And number two, is it possible still in this day and age for someone to do the same?
I certainly hope so. Thanks for that very flattering introduction. You know, when I got into science journalism, it was in the early 80s, and I think I entered it as a conventional, what I call gee whiz science journalist. In other words, I love science. I always loved it since I was a little kid. And after I lapsed from Catholicism, I thought of science as being our way to ultimate truth and understanding of the universe and understanding of ourselves, and I wanted to explore all these ways that science has of telling us what's going on in the world, and at all levels, revealing the deepest possible truths that humans can learn. And I wanted to convey that knowledge to the public from the scientists themselves, which I think is how most science journalists look at their profession. Being the conduit from the scientists to the public and celebrating science. And then something happened, so that was the early 80s, and I started working at Scientific American, and I went through a period of disillusionment. And that's when I became the provocateur that you describe, and somebody who is actually quite critical of many aspects of science and some of the things that scientists are saying, and began getting quite skeptical of string theory and unified theories of consciousness and some of these really exciting avenues for explaining the world. And just in terms of how I've made a living at it, I do feel extraordinarily lucky that I have been able basically to do what I want to do as a writer, which is not that easy. I've had some tough times. I had a very rocky period at Scientific American after The End of Science came out. There have been people who have thought my style of journalism is bad for science.
I bet.
and see me as being anti-science when I think of myself as being, I think my kind of skepticism is absolutely essential for science.
Absolutely, it is.
But I do love debunking. I love pointing out when really smart people out there are saying things that might not necessarily be so. I have found an audience, but it's not. I sometimes envy other journalists who have a kind of tribal association, mm-hmm, that they have found one theory, one ideology that they really believe in, and they promote that, and there are lots of other people who feel the same way. I feel kind of like a lone wolf roaming around saying nasty things about pretty much everything out there. And it hasn't been easy always, but it's been so much fun. And I would encourage, if there are any aspiring science writers out there, I think right now, more than ever, we really need tough, critical science journalism. We've got way too much gee whiz science journalism. And we need the critical style as a counterweight to that.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, I think it's that skeptical irreverence that you show that really shines through. And I know some people that it does probably rub them the wrong way, but I do think it's essential. And the other thing I think that I loved, one thing I found in preparation for this interview was an interview you did with the NYU School of Journalism. It's a great backgrounder. If anyone wants to learn more about John and his history, and it's really a little bit of inside baseball in terms of science journalism, but that's what I really loved about it. And I love the story that you tell about when you were duped, when you went in there with the guy with the white lab coat and you just wrote down everything he said. And as you described it, it was somewhat of a turning point for you to really trust your instincts in terms of, I get the sense that you're someone who doesn't suffer fools mildly and is probably pretty skeptical at the beginning, but like most journalists, and you get in the pomp and circumstance of this guy is the authority and has the white coat, so you kind of were seduced by that. But then when you came out of that, I think that really was somewhat of a turning point for you. It sounded like it.
Yeah. There were a number of times that happened early in my career because I was an English major, and then I went to graduate school in journalism. I loved reading popular accounts of science, books and articles in the New Yorker, New York Times, and that sort of thing. But then here I am, and I first started working for a magazine for electrical engineers, and I would encounter some of these scientists, and they're just throwing all this jargon at me, and some of them I could tell were deliberately trying to intimidate and impress me, with the sort of technical detail, and I did feel insecure. I think most science journalists would in a situation like that. At some point, I realized that if somebody is not explaining his work clearly enough so that I can understand it, then that's not necessarily my problem. It might be that person's problem. And I started trusting my own instincts. If somebody is telling me something that sounds like bullshit, well, it's not always bullshit necessarily. Sometimes it can be that I don't just understand it well enough at first. But often it would turn out to be bullshit.
Especially in this day and age of interdisciplinary work, you know, I mean, scientists have to write in that manner because their work is often being read and used by people outside of their immediate field, right?
That's right. This is actually an interesting time in science journalism. I've done a couple of pieces lately on this question of experts versus the public and how deferential the public should be and even journalists should be toward scientific experts or experts in even in non-scientific fields. And especially because of global warming, the debate over global warming and vaccines and, there are these sort of populist movements challenging some of these experts. I'm not saying I agree with those specific challenges, but what concerns me is that some journalists and scientists are saying, you know, the public should shut up and just listen to what the experts are saying. And I couldn't disagree with that more. I think that's undemocratic. I think that is not in the spirit of science as I see it. And it also would mean that it delegitimizes people like me who are non-experts, but who are paid. It's my profession to go to the scientists and try to figure out what they're saying, and not just to market their ideas to the public, but to challenge them, to consider them, to weigh the evidence for and against those claims, and try to tell people if I think that maybe they're being sold a bill of goods.
Great. I mean, I think anyone who's thoughtful would see that as an absolute vital role for someone to fill, and you do a great job of filling it. But okay, enough nicey-nicey stuff. When I sent you all this stuff, you replied like I knew you would and saying, bring it on. And I love that because in the interviews I do, I often have to kind of dance around and kind of play nice with people before I can really let go with what I've discovered and match it up with what's out there in terms of mainstream science. So we're going to have a good time. I think you've talked about a lot of the issues, as I described earlier, that we care about on this show. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to this kind of bring it on in a very fun way and in a sure. respectful way, because I think what you do is absolutely great. And I think where you're coming from, as you just described, is absolutely perfect. So if I'm wrong, I want to know that I'm wrong. I don't want to go out and spew a bunch of nonsense that doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. And I get the sense that you're the same way, like that first or those first series of interviews where you don't want to be bullshitted. Then the Terrence McKenna famous, yeah, I want to be able to tell shit from shinola. I mean, that's ultimately my goal. So
yeah.
Let's jump in and talk about consciousness. I think we're going to come back to talking about consciousness again and again. I think that there is somewhat of a misunderstanding out there in terms of the consciousness research that I've looked at. I think it gets misinterpreted and often spun in a news cycle kind of way within the science media. And the first point that I brought to your attention was this whole charade of emergent property of consciousness. That is, you'll hear folks say, oh, we've seen the light. Consciousness is not an illusion, because we know 20 years ago, that was the dominant paradigm. That was the idea that consciousness was some kind of an epiphenomena of the brain. Daniel Dennett, famous philosopher, said, yeah, consciousness is an illusion, and we built this whole materialistic neuroscience on that assumption. But in the last 20 years, there's been more and more of an eroding away at that simplistic idea, and now these guys have backpedaled into this idea of, well, maybe it's not exactly an epiphenomena, but it's an emergent property of the brain. Oh, that's what it is. Even though we don't know what the constituent elements are, even though we don't know when consciousness begins, when it ends, what are the necessary and sufficient causes of human consciousness, but we can kind of just throw this blanket over it and say, oh, it's an emergent property of the brain. Are you buying that?
Well, I think that consciousness studies, neuroscience in general, I think is the most exciting frontier in science right now. I'm kind of burned out on cosmology and particle physics. They're still peddling multiverses and string theory and the same kind of stuff that I was writing about 25 years ago. And it was pretty novel then. And now it seems stale and I don't even think it's very scientific, anymore. But neuroscience, the attempt to under, you know, what I love the fact that the greatest mystery, in the universe is right inside the skull of each and every one of us. The greatest mystery is what makes it possible to have, for us to have this conversation right now and to understand each other, to the extent that we do understand each other. I've been writing about consciousness for, almost 30 years now. And by default, I still am a materialist. I still, to the extent that I think if there will be understanding of consciousness and mind in general and all the, you know, the different aspects of the mind, it will come from probing the physiological underpinnings of the mind, which, as far as we know, is the brain itself. But it's amazing how little progress there has been in this field. And I think people are perfectly right to question the arrogance of some scientists who think that we're closing in on a solution, or just to kind of wave their hands around and throw out terms like emergent phenomenon and that sort of thing. But it is an exciting time. I think one of the things that excites me is the possibility of applied neuroscience, of having devices that can allow us to interact with machines in a much more direct way. Artificial cochleas were, you know, these are the little devices that allow deaf people to hear. They were just on the horizon when I got into science journalism in the early 80s. And there are a lot of neuroscientists who thought that they would never happen, that the coding of neural information, auditory information, was too complex to be reproduced by a little electronic device. They were wrong. There are more than 100,000 people who have artificial cochleas around the world today. Maybe it's possible to have other neural prostheses, possibly even brain chips that allow matrix style scenarios. That's kind of the hypey view of neuroscience, and I understand why people have that view. I get excited about it sometimes myself, but the fact is that we're still just kind of scratching at the surface of the brain, and it's one of those weird areas of science that seems to get more mysterious and complicated the more research we do. It's almost as though we're going backwards in a way in our understanding of ourselves.
Well, I would suggest to you that's because we keep pounding on this mind equals brain thing. And you just did it there a couple times in equating the brain with the mind. And I think that the best evidence we have is that that idea has been falsified. You know, the exciting advances, technology, engineering, great, bring it on, you know, and you want to embed an iPad in my head and all that stuff, I'll be the first one in line to sign up. Not the first one. Let me take that back. I won't be the first one. But I don't have any problem with that. What I have a problem with is the fundamental assumption, the paradigm, and where that paradigm takes us. And that is that mind equals brain, that you are this biological robot in a meaningless universe, and we can't get away from that. But the real problem that bugs me is that we have good evidence that that has been falsified. And even if you look at the story arc like I laid out there, hey, 20 years ago, no one was talking about consciousness being an emergent property. And there wasn't some discovery that brought that on. It was a default, a fallback position, because these guys who are peddling this consciousness is an illusion thing, they just got beaten down by the data. But no one ever came out and said, oh, we were wrong about that. They've instead just tried to slip this next meme in here that it's an emergent property. It's just bullshit. It doesn't hold up. And as I just said, you know, emergent property, this is what they use to talk about tornadoes or sand dunes or snowdrifts or any of the rest of that. Whenever we talk about an emergent property, we talk about knowing how it's formed. We know within a sand dune, it's from sand and wind and moisture and certain weather conditions. We can model it, but we can't do any of that with consciousness. Like I said, we can't say who is consciousness, what is consciousness, is your dog conscious, is this plant out in front of my office conscious. We can't say when it begins, we can't say when it ends, and yet we're still married to this mind equals brain thing. And I just think it doesn't hold up experimentally or philosophically.
Well, you know, maybe we have to get more explicit about where you think the model breaks down. I do think that there is tremendous confusion when it comes to how, I mean, we're talking about the mind-body problem, which is something that Plato and Socrates worried about. You know, it's if not the oldest problem, certainly one of the oldest problems of philosophy or just of human thought, sort of contemplating the oddness of reality. As I said, I think it's, for me, it's too early to abandon it just because I'm not sure what the alternative is. You know, it's bizarre to me that a major neuroscientist, Christoph Koch, who used to be one of my go-to guys for neuroscience, is now talking about panpsychism, that maybe consciousness is a kind of fundamental property of the universe, like electromagnetism and gravity.
I mean, that opens up a lot more doors. And I talked to Koch, too, and a few years ago. And I think I tried to pull him into that because what I read in his writing was him moving exactly in that direction. And he wanted to play it both ways in terms of this propping up this materialism on one hand, and on the other hand, kind of venturing into these other areas. But in terms of, again, John, if we just follow the data, I think the whole mindfulness thing, self-directed neuroplasticity, all the research that you looked into in terms of meditation for your book, Rational Mysticism, I think that research has been, again, largely, I don't want to say misinterpreted, because I think it's been interpreted very nicely. And I had Dan Harris, ABC News superstar, who wrote a best-selling book, 10% Happier, all about meditation and all about that research. Hey, that's great. But like I told Dan, we've buried the lead when we talk about that research, because what that research really tells us is that the materialistic mind equals brain model does not work, because if mind equals brain, then mind can't do anything. It can't do any real work if we have a closed system. But when we see meditators, even when, as you report in Rational Mysticism, we see them doing different things and we see them doing contradictory things, but we definitely see immaterial thought affecting the physical structure of the brain.
Here, you're touching on a really point. Let me see if I can frame it a little differently, frame it the way that that I think about this. To me, one of the issues that really obsesses me, and if you've looked at my blog, you probably noticed this, is free will. I think free will is maybe, you know, it's like the riddle within the mystery of consciousness. And it gets at this question that you're talking about, how can, you know, so the mind comes from matter, and then it creates this emergent thing, the mind, that somehow then exerts a downward influence on the matter itself. And how can that be? And what I think is necessary, and there are others who are kind of saying something similar to this, is that we need a whole new kind of causality, that we're stuck in physics causality, you know, billiard ball causality. If you've got a system with a bunch of physical objects in it, you know the forces that are acting upon that system, you can predict its course infinitely far into the future. That just obviously does not explain the world that we humans live in, where we can look into the future. Right now, I'm talking to you, I can think of a couple of different things to say that will create whole new trajectories for this conversation. I can do the same thing with my life. I can radically change the course of my life and maybe change the course of other people's lives by taking in new information that makes me see the future differently and act in a different way.
Well, John, hold on. You've just violated your idea that you're a materialist. You've also just violated the neo-Darwinist idea of evolution. You've added a new element to it, and that is that thought, immaterial thought, can direct where we go. I think that's well established. I'm totally with you. But I don't understand how you still call yourself a materialist.
My materialism is pretty expansive. I mean, for example, there are some hardcore materialists out there who deny, there are a lot of people who deny the existence of free will right now. Stephen Hawking has, Jerry Coyne.
But those two guys are dancing in the dark. They're complete morons. I mean, Jerry Coyne is a complete moron. As far as Hawking, I mean, anyone who says that philosophy is dead is obviously kind of painted themselves into a corner that they're not going to be able to think their way out of.
Right. Well, those guys are also, some people are just provocateurs because they want to, they want to piss readers off and maybe it generates more traffic. I understand that, but sometimes some of those guys say things that don't make any sense. But there are, I know because I've gotten in arguments with some of them. There are people out there who have very serious objections to free will. Francis Crick, who I interviewed for my book The End of Science, is one of the greatest minds I've ever encountered, and he did not believe, or he had serious doubts about, free will. As I said, I just think our concept of materialism and material causality needs to be enormously expanded. And by the way, maybe this comes from my taking psychedelics. I'm an old acid head. I started tripping when I was just a kid, when I was 15 years old. And I've taken psychedelics quite a few times. I've written about this in my books. And it has given me a picture of reality, whatever the hell that is, and of the mind-body problem. And these issues that we are talking about, that makes me very suspicious of any conventional explanation. So I'm a materialist with a big asterisk next to it, because I think that materialism needs to be totally revamped. And as I said, a whole new kind of physics of psychology created, which we don't even have an inkling of at this point, that gives us a more sophisticated sense of how the world works, and particularly how our human world works, and how it is that we are physical creatures, and yet we can make decisions, we can make choices that alter the course, that are at a psychological level because of a book we've read or a conversation we've had or something we've seen, that can alter our physical course through the universe.
I'm totally with you, John, although I think that really points to the larger problem with science that you touch on very nicely in your book, but also in your blog and in your many writings. And that is, I think science has become the emperor with no clothes on. So when science says there is no free will, or science says you are a biological robot, like Dawkins says, or you're a biological robot in a meaningless universe, like Lawrence Krauss says, who I just recently interviewed, the physicist.
Sure.
I think it loses credibility. And people just go on. It's like you're a lapsed Catholic. I have Catholic friends, and they don't really believe any of that stuff. They just go to church, go through the ritual and all the rest of that, and go out and have a beer with their buddies after and watch the game. I get that. That's a practical way of doing it. I think that's what science has become. No one takes that seriously. I have no free will. You're an idiot if you think that. I'm a biological robot living in a meaningless world, and I don't have the love that I think I have for my family, for my children, for my wife. Come on, that's an absurd idea. And yet we're asked to just pile that absurdity on all the other absurdities. You know, you just wrote a book, The End of War. It's another absurdity. Politics is an absurdity. And science has just become another absurdity that we just kind of shuffle along and go, well, I'm sure they're doing something over there, but they really are in the dark.
Well, I still cover science, even though I am extremely critical in much of what I say about it, because I love science. I still do think that science is our most powerful source of knowing ourselves and the universe. Although I read a lot of literature, watch a lot of movies, so I think the arts are absolutely necessary to contemplate our scientific way of knowing the world. But I do think that things are wide open right now, and it's a weird time. There's some scientists who are kind of digging trenches and becoming very arrogant and rigid and doubting and hostile toward other ways of knowing, including even the arts and, as you say, philosophy and certainly religion. If we want to get more explicit, maybe we would have to talk about the possibility of God and the possibility of the transcendent and the supernatural, the possibility of ESP. I think maybe where you and I differ is that I am, just as I am extremely skeptical of string theory and all the theories of consciousness and the origin of life that are out there right now, I am also an ESP skeptic. Even though some of my best friends are believers and believe in ghosts and reincarnation and so forth, and I certainly have a lot of people I respect believe in a God who loves us and has some idea of where we're going. I can't believe in those things. I'm too much of a doubter. I haven't seen any evidence for ESP that makes me a believer. There's no concept of a loving God who cares for humanity that is coherent to me. But I really try to be open-minded because I realize how completely inadequate scientific knowledge is for addressing some of those ultimate questions.
I get that. And I do get that in your writing and in that openness, I think, is extremely appealing. The way my approach is always to kind of return to science, because I'm a lover of science too. And I like sorting through the data and getting down to bedrock. And then I always think people can believe whatever they want. People who listen to my show and for myself, I see it as my personal spirituality isn't really relevant. My point is just to say, where does the data take us? And I think the data falsifies some of these ideas that lead us in the wrong direction and are the ladder leaning against the wrong wall, if you will. And a perfect example is near-death experience science, the research. And you've covered some of this, and I think I read an article that you wrote about Eben Alexander, who's been on this show a couple times. I think that research is largely misunderstood, not by people in the near-death experience community, research community, and I've interviewed so many of them, extremely, and you know, when you interview those people, and you have so much more experience than I do, but one, there's the misconception initially that these people are somehow crusaders for a cause, and they're not. They're just medical people, like Pim van Lommel in the Netherlands, who is a cardiologist and, you know, is bringing these people back from cardiac arrest. And they're saying, "Doc, you won't believe what I saw." Or Jeff Long, who's an oncologist in Louisiana in the United States, who, same thing, compiled the largest database of medically reviewed near-death experience cases. When you look at that science, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that consciousness is existing in at least a severely compromised brain. I'll get away from the death thing because that's a whole other topic. It's totally misunderstood again. These people are clinically dead by every means and measure we have for them. But even if we just say these people's brains are severely compromised beyond the point that we could recognize it being possible for them to have a conscious experience, and yet they have these conscious experiences, it's game over. Yet we've found a way to kind of reposition that research, ignore it, bypass it, talk about rats that, you know, the University of Michigan thing, rats in the brain burst and all stuff like that. I've had that discussion so many times. It's such a ridiculous argument. I talked to one NDE researcher and he privately told me that's the stupidest explanation yet for near-death experience science. But I come back to that science and I say, you know, that's bedrock. That's bedrock there. Either there's something wrong with that science, or it propels us into having a whole different perspective on these spiritual questions that you just mentioned.
Here's where I think we converge. One of my favorite all-time thinkers and seekers is William James, because William James he was a seeker, and yet he was a skeptic, and he was a seeker out of personal necessity. He was a very tormented person, prone to severe depression and anxiety. And he also was enormously curious and fascinated by these wild transcendent experiences that people have where they feel that they are in touch with ultimate reality. This is what he wrote about in the Varieties of Religious Experience, which is one of my favorite books, and I think still maybe the best book on extraordinary experiences like near-death experiences. I jumped into that realm with my book, Rational Mysticism, which covered near-death experiences a little bit, but mainly covered really deep mystical experiences produced in various ways, sometimes spontaneously or through meditation. But I really got into the psychedelic stuff because that's what I was familiar with myself. I've had many of these experiences. And what I come away with is something that I think this is how James concluded, that what we can say is that there are things going on in our minds and brains that are far beyond our capacity for understanding and really challenge some basic assumptions about how reality works. I described this experience that I had back in 1982 in Rational Mysticism. I also mentioned it in a briefer, more mysterious way at the end of my book, The End of Science. I had a really massive drug trip that completely knocked me out and set me into a dream world for almost 24 hours. And I've spent the rest of my life trying to understand that experience. And I still haven't. But if the hard-nosed skeptic, scientific materialist, if you will, is trying to come to grips with this, what I would say is that there's this fantastic kind of hyper imagination in our brains that creates narratives and stories and visionary worlds out of whatever stimuli. That this is what I assume happened to Ibn Alexander. It's what happened to me when I was tripping, and they suggests that there are capacities that we have that are we haven't even begun to plumb yet, and that might, if we explore them further, lead to whole new ways of knowing the world and of living in the world and of dealing with these ultimate questions that we've answered with religious explanations in the past. And, Eben Alexander, I wrote skeptically about him, mainly because he was giving a kind of, he was suggesting that these things he saw were real and that they demonstrated the existence of heaven. At least that's what I assume. And I can't go there, but I do think that the experiences are very important and need to be paid attention to and could lead in some really exciting directions.
Yeah, boy. You know, I mean, the problem with that, I always hear that from NDE skeptics. It's like, well, no, I don't believe it really means anything, but it's important to a lot of other people. So if it's important to their life, then it's important. Bullshit. Let's get down to bedrock. The big thing about Eben Alexander that always kind of aggravates me, and we've done a number of shows on it, is Eben Alexander's experience is irrelevant other than the fact that it fits into this larger body of near-death experience science for which we have a lot of solid evidence. You know, I just interviewed a guy, a philosopher from British Columbia, who is well-known, has written a book, and has a whole book dedicated to the near-death experience science and why he doesn't think it holds up to modern neuroscience. And all those explanations, we had a nice conversation, but they're also hopelessly outdated. I mean, Susan Blackmore is referenced and G.M. Worley is referenced and all these people that have been completely... I interviewed Susan Blackmore. She said flatly, you know, I haven't looked at the research in 15 years. I shouldn't be considered an authority. And I said, well, thanks for being honest. Goodbye. G.M. Worley, his points have... anesthesiologist, thoroughly disputed. The best research, people at University of Virginia, Bruce Grayson, Jan Holden at North Texas, Jeff Long is one of my favorite researchers, along with Pin Van Lommel, completely swamps all that. So what Eben Alexander, where his stuff is really important is, one, is he's expanded it beyond his experience to talk about all spiritually transformative experiences, which would include the kind of psychedelic experiences that you talk bravely about. I think you're very brave to talk about that, but it's really a game changer for that, and we have to recognize it as that. And that's the bedrock. Eben Alexander didn't have a functioning brain. And if you want to argue about that, you can, because he had, E. coli, spinal meningitis, and you can say, well, we don't really know the state of his brain. But you know what? That's why the near-death experience research was moved to the cardiac arrest ward, because we sure as shit do know what's going on when someone has a heart attack. We have about 50 years, or at least 25 good years, of EEG and other data of what happens to animals and human beings when their heart stops and their brain stops within 15 seconds. So these people have no brain, and yet they're having a conscious experience. So it's game over for all that, for that model. And we can talk nicely about it and how it could lead us to a new thing and all the rest of that. Well, let's get busy with getting on to that new paradigm, because the old paradigm has been falsified.
Okay. All right. Well, you've got me at a disadvantage because I'm not familiar with the literature that you're describing. I do think that there are, and I see this in myself, and I've seen it in others, and it's something that that pops out of a lot of modern psychology research, that humans have enormous capacities for self-deception. And for believing in things that ain't so. And so I probably err on the side of skepticism. And that's why I prefer to see these kinds of experiences that you're talking about as I just described them, as not proving anything. Quite the opposite. But shaking things up. And saying that we can't prematurely close our accounts of reality with reality, as William James put it. I mean, I went through a period after this trip that I described where I became convinced that I had figured out the secret of life, that I had this very complex theology that explained everything, and I could even explain the problem of evil. And I just eventually concluded that, I was semi-psychotic for one. I actually was worried that that because I had figured out the secret of the universe, that the universe might be unnecessary and might end. When I look back on that period, I realized that I was deceiving myself, and that in my desire to understand things, I had grasped at a straw. And I have a kind of horror of believing in things prematurely, and I actually get an aesthetic thrill out of being in a state of disbelief or suspension of belief. Not skepticism in the traditional sense, which is kind of knee-jerk aversion to ESP and religion and things like that, but just kind of an openness to whatever is coming next. And part of that comes from realizing that any theory or ideology or religion that you have is not helping you see into the world. Usually it's blocking your vision in some way. It's preventing you from seeing things. You're just seeing the ideology or the theory. That's at least the way that I justify my own worldview to myself.
Well, I think that's awesome. And I think that's why both you and I love science. The science, the promise of science is that we can strip away our biases, strip away our natural ability to form cultish kind of belief systems. Of course, those cultish belief systems cut both ways, right? So if we're going to believe that mind equals brain, or that we're a biological robot in a meaningless universe, that's just another set of beliefs and metaphysical assumptions. And I'd say we have not established that by experimentation or observation. And in fact, we've done just the opposite. So when I'm talking about near-death experience, I'm talking about the science. You know, I just referenced Dr. Jan Holden, who I really enjoy talking with. She's going to be at the International Association of Near-Death Studies. They publish a peer-reviewed journal. They have skeptics on the journal board. I mean, they are doing science. She wrote the Handbook of Near-Death Experience with Dr. Bruce Grayson from University of Virginia. They're doing science. They're publishing in peer-reviewed journals, carefully controlled studies. Now, the study that she did that I always reference, and it was also replicated by a researcher in the UK, Penny Sartori, a pretty simple experiment. They took a group of people in a cardiac arrest ward, and they had a cardiac arrest, and they interviewed them afterwards, and they broke them into two groups. One group was the control group that had a cardiac arrest and didn't have a near-death experience. The other group had a cardiac arrest and reported a near-death experience. And then they did something very simple. They interviewed them in a structured scientific way, like good scientists can do, about the resuscitation process, which happens at a time when they have a non-functioning brain. And they found that the people who had the near-death experience were statistically off the charts, more able to recall their resuscitation. And the other group, they said, I don't recall anything. I can't answer these questions. I can make up something. And that's the difference. So the point being, there's a body of real science, peer-reviewed science behind this. It's just ignored because it doesn't fit into the paradigm.
Well, here, I think you may have seen that I had a Q&A with Rupert Sheldrake last summer. Rupert Sheldrake is certainly one of the most, if not the most, prominent scientific proponent of the possibility of ESP and other psychic phenomena. And he also believes in God. I assume he believes in the afterlife, although I'm not sure. And I don't believe in any of those things. And yet I met Sheldrake at a conference in England last summer, and I just really liked the guy. He's brilliant. and extremely knowledgeable and sophisticated as he when it comes to science, as he should be, because he was trained at Cambridge, one of the great universities in the world, and has a PhD in biology. And so I did a Q&A with him for Scientific American, which is, you know, the Scientific American, to the extent it has an ideology, is extremely skeptical and anti-ESP. It's got Michael Shermer, the prominent skeptic, as a columnist. But I meet somebody like Sheldrake, and I realize I can't just dismiss this out of hand. I haven't seen enough to convince me that ESP is real, and in part because of encountering Susan Blackmore and interviewing her, whom you just mentioned. But I don't know. This is a crazy world we live in.
Yeah.
And I do think that, I'm sorry, I have to fall back to the position that I know you're tired of hearing, but that more research needs to be done and more thinking needs to be done about these things.
More research needs to be done as we block that research at every turn. You know, Sheldrake's great. I have great admiration for him. He's been on the show probably a half dozen times, and he wrote the foreword to my book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. In my book and in this show, we dug extensively into his ESP research with dogs. I know you talked about it because I read the article that you published that you're referring to. But you probably didn't dig into it to the extent that we did, including his debunker, who completely embarrasses himself, Dr. Richard Wiseman. You know, just a thumbnail sketch. Sheldrake has these reports from people that say, hey, my dog seems to know mysteriously when I'm coming home. You know, I come home at odd hours and my wife says 15 minutes before you get there, the dog's at the door. So he starts collecting all these stories, you know, just as a social, as a biologist, you know, he's interested in nature and how the world works. And he gets enough of them and he says, okay, I'm going to devise an experiment. And the experiment's pretty easy, right? You put a video camera on the dog, you put a video camera on the owner, you send him out, you bring him back at random times. Sheldrake did this experiment 200 times, got off the charts, statistically significant results. Anyone can go to his website. Anyone can look at that. Wiseman comes in, does 4 trials, completely changes the protocol in a really weird way, and then goes about this 10-year campaign of debunking, claiming he's the really originator of this research. It's shameful. So do we need more research into it, John? Sure, I'm all for that. Do we need a man on the moon effort to see whether a near-death experience is what it is? Sure. Are we ever going to see that? Is the system ingrained and devised in a way to prevent that from happening? You betcha.
I feel like this might be dodging the issue a little bit. It's definitely dodging the issue, but I'll just try to respond to that. There's so many things that I care passionately about. And one of the problems as a journalist, as a writer, I'm trying to finish my first novel, this summer. Because when I was a little kid, I wanted to write fiction and I figured, I better get to it if I'm going to do that. But I have to figure out what do I care about most, because I have to choose among all the different things that I want to write about. And I really plunged into a lot of the things that we're talking about on this show for rational mysticism. And I got, I really got immersed in that, and I got burned out on it to a certain extent, just because it's so, you know, I felt like I was shadow boxing after a while. I'd think I understood something and then it would start dissolving, under my grasp. And what I've become more concerned with over time recently is real world problems like war and poverty and, you know, the major sources of human suffering, and especially war, just because our country is by far the most warlike in the world, and because I am shocked every single day by the things that I read about my country and its conduct in the world. We're killing babies, and nobody really gives a damn. I mean, if you can't, I just don't understand the moral mindset of our country now. I think we're more hawkish than we were almost at any time in my life, and I lived through the Cold War and the Vietnam War. You know, where people are flocking to a movie like American Sniper about a psychopathic killer of women and children.
Exactly.
And so,
but John, where is the link? The link is right there. It's obvious. Materialism leads to materialism. They're linked. When we have a paradigm that tells us we have no free will, that we are biological robots, that we live in a meaningless universe, we are set up to be numbed by the kind of atrocities and absurdities you're talking about. They go hand in hand. We can't address one without addressing the other. That's my position.
You know, I disagree with that. I think that there are all too many religious fanatics with supernatural views of the world and the good battling evil.
Well, we need
evil.
To transcend that too, of course.
Yeah. As far as the atheists, the hardcore materialists, some of them are nasty and might support hawkish foreign policies, but most of the ones I know are liberal, progressive, peacenik, green type. So I'm not sure I can blame the ills of the world on material. Maybe capitalism, yes, but capitalism is not identical to materialism. I think capitalism in this country is also just grotesquely out of control, more so than at any time in my life as well. And that is linked to the militarism and the division of the world into us and them. I'm just trying to explain why I interviewed Rupert Sheldrake, but I didn't set aside lots of time to get into his research myself and figure out what's really going on and defend his views if I think that they are really substantive. To do that properly would have really required more of a commitment that I was willing to make, just because there's so much other stuff I want to do. I feel like I need to write another book about war.
Tell us about that in the time we have. You've been so generous with your time, and you've been so open to this kind of grilling that I think is really helpful. I mean, I'd love to be able to have this kind of open dialogue, but
sure.
Tell us about, you've touched a little bit about the end of war. And tell us about the novel you're writing, too. What an interesting kind of project for you, huh?
Sure. Okay. Well, first, the end of war. I'm 61 years old. I had a draft card. I could have ended up going to Vietnam, but I got a high number in the lottery. But I grew up during the Cold War, terrified that nuclear war was going to end everything at any moment. I've written a lot about war and national security issues throughout my career. I naively hoped when the Cold War ended that maybe we would enter a period of global peace. And obviously things have gone in the opposite direction, especially since 9/11. I happened to give a sermon in a church in my hometown right after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and in the discussion after my sermon, which is on the roots of war, I realized that almost everybody was extremely pessimistic about the possibility of ending war once and for all. Virtually no one thinks that that's possible. And I'm talking, these were liberal Democrats. These weren't Republican hawks in the audience. And now I've interviewed people all over the world. And the vast majority of people think that war is part of the human condition, which is a horrible, fatalistic belief that is self-fulfilling. If you think the world will always be dangerous and warlike, then of course you're going to want a strong military to make sure you win the wars when they break out. And as a result, we've got this extreme militarism in this country that is justified to a certain extent by crappy scientific theories about war being an innate human impulse, and especially in males. So I wrote The End of War basically to show that war is not inevitable. When you look at the various theories of war, what they primarily show is that war begets war. The war, the fear of war makes people warlike, and makes them carry out preemptive strikes like we did in Iraq that perpetuate war. They don't end the violence out there. They make more violence. So I wrote this book, came out a couple of years ago, and I still write about war constantly on my scientific blog, just trying to get people to wake up and realize how extraordinarily violent and hawkish we've become here in the United States. I haven't really had much of an impact yet, but I'm going to keep hammering away at it and hope for the best.
What are you doing with the novel? Are you doing something different?
The novel actually is going back to a lot of the issues that we're talking about. It's about a science writer who has all kinds of psychological problems, extreme anxiety and depression. He gets a brain implant that turns him into Buddha. I'll just leave it at that.
Wow, that's a great, great lead in. Sounds like, when's that going to be out?
Oh, I'm just finishing. I don't even know if it's going to be published. I don't have a publisher yet. This is, this is my first time writing fiction at length. And if all goes well, I'm hoping within the next year or two, it'll be out.
That's going to be awesome. And folks who want to stay up on your writing, the best place is johnhorgan.com?
Yeah, or my Scientific American blog, which is called Crosscheck. So just Google Horgan and Crosscheck and you'll find it. And I wrote about all the stuff that we're talking about and war and Buddhism and all sorts of things on that.
Yeah, we didn't have a chance to talk about Buddhism, but we talked about quite a bit. And I really do appreciate your openness and your time. And I'm a fan, so even though I'm part of the loyal opposition, as I described it, I'm going to continue staying on top of what you're doing. Thanks so much for joining me today, John.
Thank you, Alex. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to John Horgan for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up for you from this interview. What do you think about quasi-materialism, his idea that he is by default a materialist because anything we would ever know about consciousness or the mind is going to come through our brain, and therefore we're brain-based, so it is ultimately a materialist position. I hope I teed that up fairly. If not, maybe someone can rework it for me. The place to give me some feedback on that, of course, is at skeptico.com, S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O. I don't know if I'll have the new Skeptico site up by the time this comes out, but I do have a new website and somewhat of a new direction that we're going with getting this information out. But I'm tipping my hand, more on that to come. In the meantime, go check out skeptico.com in order to comment on this show or connect with me on Facebook or to jump on over to the forum and start a dialogue over there. I do have a number of really good shows coming up, many of which you listeners have helped me tremendously in either booking the guests or even in formulating some of the questions that we're doing. So I welcome anyone who wants to get involved in the show in that way. Many of you have done that. Just shoot me an email, tell me who you'd like to see on, and then be ready, because invariably I'll say, okay, why don't you go about helping me book that guest and framing up the interview a little bit. And if you have the follow through to do that, then we will most likely find a way to get that person on and you'll become a part of the show, which is something I absolutely love, is that engagement with you guys at that level of really forming what we do here. So that's great fun for me. And if you enjoy that kind of stuff, please join me. So I guess that's about it for this episode. I'll be back with you in a couple of weeks. Until then, take care and bye for now.